This is an ABC podcast.
Winston Churchill famously called it his black dog because he said it was always nipping at his heels. We call it depression. You might think that it really only affects the middle-aged or the old, but research now suggests that 50% of all mental illnesses emerge before the age of 18. Hello, Anthony Fennell here. Welcome to Future Tense. And here's some more stats for you. 2/3 of young Australians think using social media less often would make them happier, and over 1/3 get upset when their social media posts don't get enough attention. They're among the findings of the ABC's Australia Talks National Survey. Mental illness and digital technology, the good and the bad. That's our topic today.
I just wasn't happy as I used to be and just got upset so easily.
I really just felt worthless.
It's just this overcloud darkness.
Anecdotally, it does seem as if rates of depression are getting worse. But Professor Helen Christensen isn't so sure. She's the director of the aptly named Black Dog Institute, one of Australia's leading research agencies dealing with mental illness.
My reading of it is that it's not getting worse, though we don't have very good data sets. So we've only really done proper population data collection over two occasions. The last time was in 2008. And basically, the prevalence of depression had not increased. I know that people think that it's increasing, but again, that's usually based on selected samples. So people ask people to say how depressed they are or what their suicide ideation is, and you get higher rates there because you've got a selected population group. By saying, though, that it isn't increasing doesn't mean it's one of the biggest problems that's facing us, and I do think that there's a lot of denial around it. As our population group, say adolescence increases, for example, then we will see an increase in the number of people overall who might be having mental health problems because they do develop around adolescence. So if the proportion of the population is leaning more to more young people, then you will get a reflection of that in the population size. I mean, that might sound like I've just contradicted myself, but what I'm saying is that overall, if you just look at each of the population groups, the prevalence is the same. But if we're getting increasing change in the composition of our population groups and more young people are making up the total population of Australia, then you will see an increase in the prevalence of depression simply because it emerges in adolescence.
In the past 10 years, the stigma around mental illness has diminished significantly. It's now a mainstream media discussion issue. But I think it's fair to say that there's still a lot of confusion about the subject. Feeling incredibly down about the way the world is heading, and Donald Trump, for example, doesn't make one a depressive. It just makes you a normal human being. One popular modern belief about depression is that it can be exacerbated by social media. Mental health researcher Dr. Bridie Ann O'Day is sceptical about a genuine link.
So since the onset of social media, scientists have been looking at the relationship between social media and mood. And they've conducted a number of surveys which are able to compare our mental health and compare how much we use social media. And despite the anecdotal evidence that you've just reported, so people saying that social media can make them feel worse, we don't see those findings replicated in the studies. And in fact, although there is a link between social media use and mood, it is very low and very small. And depression and anxiety and most mental health issues are very complex, and therefore pinpointing it down to a single activity such as time spent on social media, in fact, oversimplifies mental health. And therefore, these types of findings and this sentiment is not very helpful for people who are experiencing mental health problems.
Because the people who turn up on social media suffering from mental health may well have been suffering from mental health before they went onto social media. There's not necessarily a causal relationship.
That's right. And that's, unfortunately, we can't look at the longitudinal relationship between social media use and mood at this point in time because we don't have the studies that are following people and measuring their mental health over time to see whether or not there is a link. So currently, the science still shows that although there may be a link there, the relationship is very weak and very small.
But that's not necessarily the way Dr. Brian Primack sees it. Dr. Primack is the Dean of the University of Pittsburgh Honors College. He agrees the overall findings are inconclusive, but based on his own recent research, he also believes the link between mood and social media usage is more significant than Dr. O'Day suggests.
There had been a lot of anecdotal findings that showed various things related to social media and depression. Some studies had shown that using a lot of social media can actually help depression. It can reduce feeling socially isolated. It can increase your feeling of social capital. And those are things that might be related to less depression. Whereas other studies had shown that perhaps by being exposed to a lot of social media, we are exposed to unrealistic images that make ourselves feel bad about our lives. So what we decided to do was the first large nationally representative study in the United States focusing on 18 to 30-year-olds. So we partnered with a company that specializes in obtaining nationally representative data, and we leveraged that partnership to get responses from about 2,000 young adults ages 18 to 30. And when we computed all of our results, we accounted for waiting and non-response and that type of thing so that our results could be nationally representative. We originally hypothesized that there would be more of a U-shaped relationship, meaning that people who had very, very little social media exposure actually had more depression than people who had moderate amounts of social media exposure. We assumed that moderate amounts of social media exposure would be sort of normative and that it might give people more support, and therefore that would be sort of the bottom of the U. But what we found was very different. We found basically a straight line. People who had the most social media use also had the most depression, and it was a statistically significant linear relationship. And it was a pretty substantial association as well. For example, those people who were in the top quartile with regard to social media use compared with those in the bottom quartile were about 2 to 3 times as likely to be depressed and to also be anxious.
And is it right that what you found was that there was also a link between depression and the number of platforms that you use? So the more platforms you use, the more likely you are to have your mood affected.
Yes, that was a subsequent analysis, and that was also surprising because in that study, we controlled for the total time spent on social media. So we sort of compared one person who uses 2 hours a day of social media, but only does that on one or two platforms versus somebody who spends that exact same 2 hours a day, but spreads it out among 7 or 8 platforms. And surprisingly, that person who spreads it out over 7 or 8 platforms was actually about 3 times as likely to be depressed, according to our measures.
How should we read that result? Why would using numerous platforms make you more inclined towards a negative mood state?
Well, there are a couple of possibilities. At this point, we certainly don't know the answer, but I think that there are a couple of things worth considering. One is that every social media platform is very idiosyncratic. It comes with its own unspoken rules. It comes with its own sort of milieu that you learn to understand and work with. And So if you are trying to navigate one or two of these, you very well might become extremely familiar with and understanding of those idiosyncrasies and those ways of navigating those platforms. But if you're trying to do this with seven or eight different platforms, you might just get out of hand. You might be more likely to make some kind of a major gaffe that's embarrassing. You might not really feel like you've actually broken into that culture and so that you've obtained the benefit. It's sort of like in high school, if you're trying to be friends with a couple of different groups of people, that's probably okay. But if you're trying to become good friends with seven or eight different groups of people, that might be a little bit more challenging.
Another study from the UK this year by the Royal Society for Public Health indicated that some platforms are more damaging than others when it comes to young people's mental health, the worst being Instagram, according to the Royal Society for Public Health. Is this something that you've come across, that you've found? Is there a difference between the different platforms with regard to mental health?
It's a very good question, and that is not something that we have looked at specifically, but I am familiar with that study. And I think one of the things that they mentioned in the discussion is that that might be because Instagram is more of a visual platform. So it may not be anything specific about Instagram itself. It just may be that a lot of the things that we are concerned about that might be purveyors of depression might be very easily demonstrated visually. For example, when people see the posts of other people that they know and they see these highly curated, highly idealized images, it very well may make them feel that they are less adequate. You know, that they're not having as good lives as everybody else. Whereas in a more text-driven, a less visual platform such as Twitter, you know, that might not be quite as powerful.
So your research, as you've said, has drawn a link between the use of social media and depression. But could it be that people with a propensity for depression simply use more social media sites in the first place?
Absolutely. And I'm very glad that you brought that up. And it's very much worth underscoring that the work that we've done and most work in this area so far has been cross-sectional, meaning that we really cannot disentangle cause and effect. And even though it certainly could be that a lot of exposure to images like these might induce depression, as you say, it very well may also be that people who are depressed, for example, are not as likely to take real social risks, to go out and see other people. And so then that might leave them there alone with their internet. Similarly, with regard to that other finding around the number of platforms, you could also cook up a reasonable explanation. For example, you could say that people who are depressed, instead of just being satisfied with one or two platforms where they really feel like they've gotten to know people, maybe they're sort of on a constant search. And so they're trying, you know, three, four, they don't really find it there. So they try a couple more platforms and they're looking for it here and there. And so it's a very important point that you bring up, that it very well could be in either direction. And finally, as we often find in social science such as this, it very well could be a combination of both. And that could be concerning because it might bring up the idea of a vicious cycle. It may be that somebody who starts to become a little bit more introverted or depressed starts to use more social media instead of actually forming real social relationships. Then they are exposed to messages that might make them feel a little bit more like everyone else is having a good life and make them feel a little bit more depressed. And then they start to use more social media, etc. So these are the kinds of things that we hope to look at in the future through longitudinal research.
And no matter where you are or how you're listening, you're with Future Tense. New ideas, new approaches, new technologies. The edge of change. I'm Anthony Fennell. As I flagged at the beginning of the program, there's also an upside to the effect technology can potentially have on mood. There's a plethora of apps out there that promise to help people deal with depression and anxiety. Using technology to treat mental illness has long been a focus of the work of Dr. Helen Christensen at the Black Dog Institute. And the apps that she's worked on employ what's known in psychology as cognitive behaviour therapy.
Cognitive behaviour therapy is what's often called a talking therapy, and it uses psychotherapeutic techniques to change the way people think about particular issues. So, for example, if people are thinking it's their fault because a particular outcome occurred, or that it's the fault of a particular event that happened, then it's really changing why you would necessarily think that it was your fault that that was the case. So, I mean, there's lots of different examples, but often young people feel, if you like, the imposter syndrome, where they think they are either ugly or stupid. Because a particular event happened, they may not have done as well in their school certificate or other stressors. And cognitive behaviour therapy would be about getting them to think that they're thinking in a very biased way about attributing a single outcome to their whole personality and to their whole being. So just because this bad thing happened doesn't mean you're a bad person or you're an inadequate person or an unattractive person.
And as I said, you've been working for more than 15 years, as I understand it, at how you can use the benefits or transfer the benefits of cognitive behaviour therapy across to new forms of technology. Just explain to us about some of the experimentation that you've done around that.
Sure. So just going back a long time, I think it was about 17 years ago, we developed this program called Mood Gym, which essentially was delivering cognitive behavior therapy through the internet directly to people who may not be able to get access to health services. At that time, there weren't headspaces. There wasn't much access that was available through Medicare for psychology. So the idea is, you know, you can turn a manual about how to help yourself into a useful interactive therapeutic program online. And we've been doing that for, you know, 17 years in various different ways and different types of programs, whether they're directed young people or old people. I guess there's been a couple of new things happen over that period of time. The first, of course, is the development of the smartphone in 2008. That's completely revolutionized the way in which you can get access to people and also the capability of what you can do on a mobile phone that's much more interactive. And also, somewhat scaringly, I guess, is that the amount of information a phone will tell us about particular people. And what we're trying to do is harness, for example, the smartphone and apps as a better way of delivering what we were doing on the web, you know, 17 years ago. I mean, 17 years ago, you hardly had a connection. The internet used to make that terrible noise when you were kind of logging through to it. It's really changed. So the smartphone really has revolutionized what we're capable of doing now. And the second thing has changed is really the social communities and online communities that now can connect with each other so easily. I mean, really, that wasn't something that was readily available 17 years ago. And the growth of peer support groups and bulletin boards and online communities has also changed the potential for how the technology can interact into both supporting people and delivering therapies.
And you argue, don't you, that it is having a very real impact, because I guess a lot of us might have a bias that, you know, traditional face-to-face therapy is always going to be much more effective, but that seems not to be the case from your research, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. And I just come back from the ISRI conference in Berlin, and that was the bottom line. That for a long time, I used to have these debates with people in other countries like Sweden and Denmark and the Netherlands, and they were doing blended or face-to-face therapies, and they were always finding that these online programs did worse. But now they're coming around to the fact that actually they're just as effective as face-to-face, which in itself raises some really interesting questions, doesn't it, about what technology can do and what people can do for themselves and also how they prefer to get their therapy.
So what are some of the benefits of taking that technological approach? What does it offer that perhaps traditional face-to-face therapy doesn't?
Well, I'd have to say that we have to take in the preferences of people here, because I don't think people who are convinced that face-to-face is going to work and that online isn't going to work, it's probably a better choice for them to do face-to-face. So people's preferences for how they want to do these things is absolutely critical. But there's just been a very interesting recent paper published showing that a chatbot, you know, based on artificial intelligence, did better than a non, I think it was, I don't know if it was face-to-face, I can't actually remember, but compared to a control group. And people actually got better from a completely automated chatbot. So we're moving into a different arena where chatbots are getting more and more intelligent and they're capable of helping people to manage their own mental health.
You know, I think digital health offers a whole world of exciting new possibilities for people suffering with depression. One of the most exciting things is that it can bring in a lot of new information and clinical data about what is the lived experience, what is actually happening on a daily life, minute by minute, hour by hour, day by day of people who are experiencing depression.
That's Dr. John Torres, the co-director of the Digital Psychiatry Program at Harvard Medical School. He also chairs the American Psychiatric Association's working group on smartphone app evaluation.
Oftentimes, the way that we learn about as doctors and clinicians about depression is people come into the clinic visit and we ask them, how are you feeling? What have your symptoms been? How has the last month been? How has the last 3 months been? Sometimes, how has the last year been? And the exciting part about this kind of behavioral digital health technology is we have the potential to capture a lot of exciting real-time data that may give us some clues about how people are feeling and how they're functioning in the real life in the community. So there's a potential to bring in a lot of new data that patients and doctors can use together to make more informed decisions about care. On the flip side, too, there's the potential to begin to deliver interventions and treatments remotely, where certainly, I said, for many people back home for me in the States, I imagine here too, is it can be difficult to see a mental health professional, a therapist, a psychologist, a psychiatrist. There's simply limited access to care. With these digital behavioral health technologies, we can begin to push evidence-based interventions through smartphones. We can offer people teletherapy via their computers. We can encourage people to do healthy habits via wearables. We can really kind of intervene and kind of help people make good decisions and work towards improved mental health outside the clinic when in their real life.
And do you see that kind of passive data, if you like, that can be collected via those sorts of applications, do you see that being useful in terms of preventing a relapse, if somebody who's on the road to recovery and preventing them from relapsing?
So I think that passive data has exciting potential for helping us learn about relapse and predict it early. Oftentimes in illnesses like schizophrenia, right now the biggest risk factor for relapse prediction is stopping taking your medications. But if you think about it, that's kind of already too late in the downstream effect where we want to intervene. We want to be able to intervene and know someone's at risk of relapse before it gets to the point where they stop taking their medications. The exciting part of the passive data is it can begin to offer us clues and signals of when someone may be at higher risk. We actually just finished up a small pilot study at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center and Harvard Medical School, where we had 20 people with schizophrenia use a smartphone app developed at the Harvard School of Public Health by J.P. Onella. And what we did with this app is we were able to monitor location with people's informed consent from their smartphone. We were able to monitor how social they were on the smartphone, again, with their informed consent by looking at the number of incoming and outgoing calls. And we were able to offer people symptom surveys. And so this app was running in the background on patients who had schizophrenia. And in patients who relapsed, we noticed that there were changes in how they used their phone. By that, I mean there were changes in how social they were and how active they were. And those changes were happening in the week before relapse. So it was a very small pilot study. But I think it shows us first that people with schizophrenia and people with psychotic disorders can successfully use this technology, and said no one had any complaints, no one got worried or anxious or paranoid by it. And perhaps equally important is there's likely a signal there, and that certainly when you're not feeling well, you're at risk of relapse, you may feel different, you may begin acting different, and the phone may be a proxy to pick that up. And in this case, that proxy was there's a difference in the way you use your phone to communicate, and there's a difference in your mobility, how active you are, is picked up by the phone sensors like accelerometer and GPS.
Hey guys, it's Hannah, author of Mental Health for the Digital Generation. Today I'm gonna talk about mental health apps and the benefits of them and why they're really important.
This is where, as a scientist and anxiety specialist, I answer your most pressing questions relating to panic attacks so that we can help you finally get back
to normal.
Hey guys,
so I'm here chilling, and today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the apps that I use regularly to help me cope with my anxiety. I've spoken about it many, many times.
We've seen over the last couple of years an explosion, if you like, in the number of mental health apps that are available online. Why do you think we are seeing so many more of these now, these days? What's the appeal? What's driving it?
You know, I think what's driving it is there used to be this notion of a digital divide, the idea of being people with mental health disorders, perhaps, didn't own technology, they were afraid of using smartphones, they didn't want to use technology in their care. I think that was never truly the case, but as we've seen that smartphones and technology becomes increasingly affordable, everyone has it, people are using it, everyone is interested in technology, regardless if you have a mental illness, I think we're seeing that digital divide, people realize it's closing, there's an opportunity to now kind of deliver these apps and these tools at scales at a population level. And you're absolutely right that there's perhaps, you could almost say there's too many apps. Our group in Boston actually did a research paper. We tried to figure out how many mental health apps are there on those commercials, marketplaces like the iTunes or Android store that you could download today, here, and now. And we think there's at least 10,000 mental health related apps out there. And 10,000 is a huge number. Less than 1% of them have probably ever been reviewed or studied. So it's become this marketplace where there's some really great apps that may be useful to improve care, but there's also a lot of untested apps, there's a lot of dangerous apps, there's a lot of things that you don't want to be using. So one of the projects I work on with the American Psychiatric Association, I chair our work group on smartphone app evaluation, which really is seeking to give guidance to help clinicians and to help patients figure out what would be a useful app, what would be a good app, and which are ones that I should avoid. Because as you said, there's so many of them and they're spreading so quickly.
I think apps are such an untapped resource.
Hey, welcome back to Undefined Therapy. And today we're
going to recommend something to you if I don't make
sense. Today we're going to be talking about high functioning depression.
They also have SOS,
for those of you that are really familiar,
really kind of
with
really anxious kind of panic.
If we really want to prevent suicide, we have to have methods that are in real time. And social media enables that. It has the potential for us to identify who needs help and intervene within minutes. And I think that in the context of suicide prevention, moving into the future, the community demands us of that to investigate the potential of that to save lives.
Mental health researcher Dr. Bridianne O'Day. So digital technology and social media, problematic as they sometimes might be, well, they're also part of the solution for mental health. And a reminder that if you're suffering from a mental health issue and desperately need to talk to someone, you can, of course, call Beyond Blue or Lifeline. You'll find their phone numbers on the Future Tense website. The ABC's Australia Talks National Survey looks at how you really feel about a broad range of topics, including mental health. Just head to abc.net.au/Australia Talks to find out more about the issues that matter. My co-producer here at Future Tense is Karen Savanovitz. I'm Anthony Fennell. Until next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.